What's up, everybody? Here we are in St. Pete. I am at otterpr.com with Jay Feldman, the founder, and we're about to go knock out an awesome podcast, mentorscollective.com podcast. Check out the episode. It's coming up.
Welcome to Mentors Collective. I'm joined by a friend who I met coincidentally. There's a funny story that I'm going to tell you from down in Miami. And I'm super excited to have him on the show because he is one of the fathers and pioneers of fitness challenges. He's made a lot of money. He's built large companies, exited quite a few of them, and now is going to be speaking at RiseCon conference this weekend. Congratulations for that.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming to join me in our St. Pete office and our studio here.
Beautiful office, by the way.
Thank you.
Well done.
Appreciate you saying that.
Great team.
Great condo when I came to visit down in Miami. I've never been so mind blown walking into a place, and it's such a funny coincidence and story. I had no idea what I was walking into.
Yeah.
So just to tell that story of how we met,
Nick. Great transition.
It's a great transition. Coincidentally, ended up at a penthouse party in Miami through a friend, and it was a pretty barren apartment, pretty barren condo, but huge.
Yep.
Just like, what the hell do these people do? And we had run out of alcohol towards late into the night.
Right. That's why we went downstairs.
And I was down there shooting the shit with you and a few girls around the table. And I'm like, oh, we should go do a liquor run or I can order something. And you're like, no need. I live right upstairs. Why don't you come up with me? Help me carry some of the alcohol down. Took me up the stairs, opened up the front door. And my God, if I've ever seen a pad before, this was it. You had art like I've never seen before, just a giant open space. I didn't even know things like that existed in Miami.
Yeah, we got lucky, for sure.
100%. I mean, life is...
The space was super rare. You know, it was just a wide open... It's probably, not counting the balcony, it's probably like 4,400 square feet, and most of it's just wide open.
You really don't see that every day.
No,
love that open layout. It's awesome.
The penthouse that you were in, I was penthouse one, and they were penthouse two. It was much more boxy. They had redone everything ultra modern, and you know, for everyone that's watching, my neighbor would rent out his place, or his nephew would have parties at his place all the time. So I never know, is he renting it this weekend to a party, or is his nephew throwing a party? So I just get in when I get in with the line of people, and instead of going to my place, which is penthouse, I just go to his place, and it just opens up, and I'm in there, right? So we were like, fuck it, let's crash the party. And we walked in and just met you, and we went down the stairs to my place and grabbed all the alcohol and came back up. So random chance occurrence. We didn't talk any business.
No, none.
And I spent probably more time talking with your friend, and then you said that he had made the connection through Instagram. That's how we connected or reconnected.
Yes. So I remember going into your place, just eyes wide open, like, what the hell is this? And then I'm like, man, what do you do? And you said, fitness challenges. I'm like, this guy's the man. We got down, didn't get any of your information when we left. And the guy you were connected with, Dr. Jarrett, probably 3-6 months later, sends me a video of you. I'm like, oh my God, that's him. So I reached out, made the connection, and I think we planned to do this maybe a year ago. So here we finally are.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, brother. So with all that being said, with that introduction, what is it that led to your success? Take me through the timeline of your success.
Sure. Super short version is from Michigan originally, very blue collar, middle class upbringing. So all four of my grandparents worked at the same factory, dad, uncles, brothers. I wanted to be rich one day, and I was like, all right, I can't sing, I can't dance, I can't rhyme, I can't act. I'm not going to do anything illegal, so that left sports. So I went on and played college baseball. While playing college baseball, I got introduced to direct sales network marketing. I had no idea what it was. I was just kind of like the kid at the mall that got recruited and drank the Kool-Aid. Yep. I was like, whoa, you can get rich doing this? Let's do this. And for the first 2 years, I built a little side business and learned sales while playing baseball. And then, you know, I started making a couple grand a month, and I said, okay, I think I can invest all the time I'm putting into school and baseball into this, and I might be able to create a path of, you know, millions. Yeah. And I knew baseball had a physical limitation, and this is the first time now I'm learning some form of entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I'm realizing there's no limitation physically on entrepreneurship. It's only emotionally or mentally, right? You need a little bit of brains and you need a whole lot of heart and desire and conviction and passion. So I said, let's go for it. I went all in, and then mastered leadership, made my first million at 25. The company went out of business. I bought the assets of the company, created a company called Visalis that ran for 15 years, 19 countries, couple billion in sales, 3.6 million customers. It was just, Jesus. It was insane. The highest of all highs and the lowest of all lows, the most insane of the roller coaster.
Yeah, and I saw some stuff. I'm excited to hear a little bit about that. I didn't know that you played college baseball. And yeah. I love talking to entrepreneurs who come from athletic backgrounds, and it's more common than you think, especially at that elite level.
Yeah.
I don't know if you knew it about me. I played professional volleyball growing up.
No, I didn't know that.
That's I played great. Collegiate volleyball all through college, played for the All-State team. And I think that played a big part in my development as an entrepreneur.
Discipline, leadership, team building.
Right. Tell me a little bit about that. Let's dive deeper. Do you think baseball...
No, it's the 100% exact correlation. So my whole life was about, I'm going to have to be a professional athlete because I want to have this certain lifestyle because I didn't know entrepreneurship existed. And so I put everything I had nonstop around the clock into being better at a sport. And then when I realized you could do the same thing for entrepreneurship, I then just shifted all the same work ethic, desire, focus, you know, work when the coach isn't looking type attitude.
Yeah.
Into building a business and then working on myself for 10 years. And the only people that can, this is age 20 to 30. There's only a few people that could validate this, which would be like my roommate at the time or my ex-girl from age 26 to 30. If it didn't have to do with building my business, my body or my brain, I didn't do it. 100 hours a week, I was a robot. So I gave up my 20s. Which created, you know, wealth in my 30s.
Interesting. I feel like a lot of people don't do that, especially during your 20s. Most people are in college, they're traveling, they're partying. What do you think drove you to give all that up? I mean, you're a good-looking guy. You seem relatively socially capable.
Yeah.
I'm sure there was a lot of temptation along the way.
You know, I referenced it earlier. I drank the Kool-Aid. So I believed the quotes, the stories. Yes. I believed Think and Grow Rich. I believed... I just had complete faith that if you did nothing but focus on the goal or the outcome or the dream and you didn't get distracted, that it would work. And it did. I know that sounds cliche and it sounds stupid. People are like, oh, what would you tell the younger self of you? Go harder earlier. Go faster earlier. Mm-hmm. Like, well, you sacrificed everything. I'm like, no, I can think of all kinds of stuff that I would have sacrificed even faster knowing the outcome. So it was just having the faith and the naive willingness to go all in early. And when people are like, oh, these are the best years of your life. I'm like, yeah, if you can be at a job you hate for the rest of your fucking life, yeah, college would be the best time of your life. Yeah. You know, but if you plan on, you know, creating lifestyle and financial freedom and time freedom, then, you know, the best years are to come.
Yeah, I mean, now you get to spend the rest of your life doing whatever you want with no limitations. So I'd say that's worth the trade-off for sure.
It's definitely worth the trade-off.
Now, MLMs, network marketing, pyramid schemes, they get a bad rap. Yeah. But I believe there's a lot of benefit, especially when you're starting out.
Sure.
Tell me a little bit about your intro with MLMs and why that helped you as an entrepreneur.
Well, it's funny now because now almost everything is trying to figure out how to create an affiliate program. Mm-hmm. So an affiliate program is the exact same thing as multi-level, except... your affiliate levels just keep going like, you know, this. It's the same thing. Affiliate program is a great way to rename multi-level marketing. So a two-level affiliate is just a legal kind of denotation. Three levels is now underneath the law. So people think it's a marketing label. It's not a marketing label. It's actually a legal label.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, if you have three levels or more, you're a multi-level marketing company. If you stop at two, you're affiliate or party plan. And you know,
are you treated differently under the law as an MLM?
Yeah. So, you know, bottom line is if the company is selling, and actually the law is 2/3, 1/3. If two thirds of your revenue as a company comes from customer acquisition and less than 1/3 comes from the purchases of your distributors, then you're fine. So an actual pyramid is when you have people telling people who are only making money by buying the products themselves and having people buy the products and no sales to customers. So we use the multi-level marketing compensation model to drive customer acquisition, right? So the companies that do that are really just intelligently compensating people.
Yeah.
But there's no distinction from a company that does it wrong and a company that does it right. It's just they're in the same industry. One's getting customers, one's not getting customers.
Right.
You know, so the bad rap comes from the ones that don't get customers.
I think one of the strongest things or arguments for MLMs is their sales training and their ability to brainwash you in a good way, the way that you were by your MLM. It was your introduction into business that you may have never had without that opportunity and them prospecting you. Do you think MLMs are a good way for entrepreneurs to start, to get into the action?
I think it's the only place to start, because anything else you're starting, yes, you can plug into communities or podcasts or content, but to plug into something where there's a line of people who are incentivized to see you grow, win, and succeed. They're literally, well, they're getting paid off me. Yeah. So they want you to succeed. The more you make, the more they make. So logically, they're going to pour into you to see you succeed. Who else is going to do that when you open a restaurant? Nobody. That's why they all fail. Right? That's why 90% of all businesses fail in the first 3 years, 95% fail in the first 5 years. Why? Because they're the lack of support, right? Yeah. It's like, who do you go to? Your competition for the answers? No, they want you to close. So I think anyone who wants to start first time, spare time, there's no risk. Yeah, you spent a couple $100 and got some products, who cares? You spent a couple $100 on training, you do that at the bar. You got around thousands of people that all have big goals, dreams, aspirations to do something awesome. They're forcing you to read books and be better. I mean, I highly recommend it to anyone. But it's actually driven, ironically, by the stay-at-home mom. So 70% of all people in the direct sales industry are stay-at-home moms who aren't trying to get rich. They're not trying to retire. They're just trying to make an extra $2,000 a month and not have to talk to five-year-olds all day long and still come in and out of a business that's challenging them and fun and interesting around products that they really like and enjoy, that's growing them. And a lot of them hit it huge, like 10, 20, 30, 100 grand a month, especially now with social media.
Right. Social media, I think, has given them superpowers. Yeah. Yep. And you see the cars riding around. I was telling you before the episode, the Mary Kay riding around in the pink Escalade. They got me.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. And I'd
rock a pink Ferrari.
I'd rock a pink Ferrari. No one's going to judge you riding around in a pink Ferrari. They can judge all they want.
Like, is this mom's? No, it's mine. I got a pink Ferrari. Sorry. Go. My bad. Go ahead.
You're okay. So you've done some really big things in the world and pioneered a few different industries, one being challenges, which everybody is using nowadays. If you haven't heard of a fitness challenge, you have been living under a rock.
Yep.
Tell me about your journey and your involvement in fitness challenges. And what was that like as a pioneer, and where is it now?
Yeah, candidly, it was an accident. And I mentioned earlier, hey, we were the MySpace of challenge marketing. And you're like, oh, that's great. I'm like, no, it's terrible. We're the MySpace. We weren't the Facebook, right? So Beachbody is the Facebook. Yeah. They fucking took our idea identical and buried us. But we were in business for a couple years, just our traditional business model. We were a high-end anti-aging supplement company. We had gotten to, in year three, $35 million a year in sales, decent little company. And then we got bought in a four-year buyout. And the 2 months after the announcement of the transaction is when the economy plummeted. I don't remember if you remember October, November 2008.
Yep.
That was the beginning of the crash. So our sales went from $3 million a month to $600,000 a month in 1 year. So we were 1 month from out of business. We had $600,000 in the bank. We were doing $600,000 in sales, and we were losing $600,000 a month in cash. So it was a 666 you didn't want. And we knew we had to pivot, because high-end anti-aging supplements, people, I don't know if you remember 2009, people were like, I can't pay my light bill.
Yeah, we lost our house. Like, I remember.
It was any ancillary, anything was gone, right? So we pivoted to our third product. We already had the product. Nobody really wanted it, which was a really great tasting meal replacement shake. Mm-hmm. But because we were high-end supplements, double patented anti-aging, you know, reverses the effects of DNA damage at a molecular level, like all this shit, right? Mm-hmm. And it was all true. But nobody wanted to buy that, and our leaders didn't want to sell the shake. And we had to make a tough decision, and we said, all right, we need to pivot to the shake, because we can position this as meal replacement.
Yeah.
So this is cheaper than McDonald's, it's cheaper than Burger King, it's cheaper than fast food, and it's healthy. But that's not enough, so what are we going to do? And I don't know if you know Coach Dale Brown. He's the guy that found Shaquille O'Neal in Germany when he was 15.
Wow.
And then mentored him to 18 and brought him to LSU. So he's Coach Dale Brown is Shaq's coach at LSU. He's the winningest coach in SEC basketball, Hall of Famer, blah, blah, blah. And he is a close friend to the founders of our company at that time. And in 2008, he points to my business partner and says, I challenge you to the Dale Brown challenge. At this point, this guy's 72. He goes, we're like, what's that? He goes, you must work out every single day for 1 hour and run 1 mile a day, 365 days straight. Nobody's ever beat me in it. I challenge you. So my partner accepts the challenge, and everyone around the idea, this is before Facebook, this is 2008. We are all like, how's the challenge going? Tell us about the challenge. How's your challenge going? I want to be in the challenge. And then all of a sudden there's 100 people. They're like, we joined the Dale Brown challenge. Like, there's no, Dale just challenged, you know, Ryan. There's no Dale Brown challenge. So 2009, fast forward, we're in the room like, what if we took that idea and we launched Body by Vi, the 90-day challenge? At that time, there was no weight loss and fitness challenges.
Wow.
People like, oh, the Pepsi challenge, that's the first challenge. Like, it's completely different.
Yeah.
This is a taste test, right? We were the first, like, challenge your, you know, take on a 90-day challenge. And what it was set a goal, select a kit, enter to win. We had $100,000 in prizes and this, that, and you get free product and all this shit. And it just went completely viral. It exploded. We went from 600,000 a month to 66 million a month in sales in 33 months.
During a hardcore recession.
Yeah. So, I mean, we came out of our low. Yeah, it was like January 2010. December 2010 was 600,000 a month of sales. So we're just starting to climb out of the recession as a as a country.
Yes.
But yeah, at the tail end of it. And then we bought challenge.com. And then by 2012, we're every celebrity is joining the challenge. We weren't even paying them. But it made sense because as an athlete or celeb, you could market that and it's like, hey, we got the Hulk Hogan challenge. We got the Master P challenge, Romeo and Master P, father son challenge. Everybody was doing it. It was crazy.
Was doing your challenge when you made. Yeah,
And we'd make a website for them and it'd be join the Master P challenge.
Right. Now all of their fans can follow their journey during the challenge.
Correct. In fact, we had Chris Humphries while he was engaged to Kardashian.
Yeah.
So Chris had his challenge. All kinds of folks, and it just organically exploded, and then everyone launched a weight loss and fitness challenge, which really muddled the message.
Yeah.
Because when on social media, you can't tell the difference if you're an outsider between your personal trainer's 7-day challenge, your gym's 30-day challenge, Weight Watchers' new challenge, Herbalife's challenge. And we had a lot of internal issues, a lot of internal issues, which really are responsible for, you know, the demise of the company. But Beachbody just buried us. They looked at it, at the growth. They said, fuck that. We can make a shake. Made a shake, same color.
Oh, wow.
Black and green and silver. They didn't even change the number. $100,000 challenge, $100,000 challenge, 90 days. They didn't even decide to change anything. Like, we don't care.
Did you fight them on this?
No, because not you can't. There was nothing that you could really copyright or trademark inside of that. It's like, so no, we didn't. And they had a much better mousetrap because if you remember, P90X was at its peak in 2011. Mm-hmm. So here's what they did. They had 200 million in sales or more happening through direct to consumer and television ads.
Yeah.
We didn't have any television ads. So they added an MLM arm, which was their 90-day challenge with their shake. And every time a phone call came in to buy a P90X workout, they'd say, would you like a shake and a coach? Absolutely, I want a shake and a coach. It's fucking Tony Horton. Yeah. Well, it wasn't Tony Horton. It was their MLM. So they just take the lead, transfer it over to a coach who is a soccer mom, who was probably 50 pounds overweight drinking the shake.
Yep, teed up, ready for the sale.
Boom. And they just had a much better lead engine.
Yeah, that's genius.
They killed us. They're still probably a $2 billion market cap today, and we don't exist.
If you could go back to when you were dominating the market and do anything different to prevent yourself from being the MySpace, is there anything that you would change?
Fucking Tom.
You're Tom.
I'm not Tom. You're Tom. We have four founders can argue over that. The answer is absolutely. You know, we're probably a a lesson on what to do for 3 years and then what not to do for 3 years, you know? So there's probably college courses on here's what to do and then here's what not to do. So I think the biggest issue, which led to all the other issues, is we had a structure, a corporate structure, major crisis. Mm-hmm. Crisis. The company that bought us was a $1.2 billion, 30-year, 20-country holding company that owned multiple direct sales companies. To us, that's a dream come true as guys in our late 20s,
yeah,
doing $3 million a month. Then we crash to $600,000. We come up with a new idea. They're like, your idea of a challenge marketing is stupid. They're publicly traded. They literally wrote us down against their taxes. What that means is they claimed us as a write-down, their investment.
Interesting.
Which is about the most embarrassing thing that can happen to you in business.
Like a loss.
Yeah, they exactly. Like, yeah. Visalis was such a bad investment, we want a tax break, right? It's different than when your uncle writes you off. When a publicly traded company writes you off, it's very different. So they said, you think that idea of a 90-day challenge is going to work? You fund it. So we took our last $1 million each as founders, put it back in, put a really high premium on it. So if it worked, they had to buy that that paper out, that loan out. And it worked. All of a sudden, they owned, one of the companies they owned was Party Light Candles. I don't know if you remember that brand.
No.
Party Light was $900 million a year, maybe 30 countries, all women selling candles in the home. Well, after the recession, candles didn't recover. $30, $40 candles did not recover. So their company dropped by hundreds of millions of dollars.
Jesus.
While ours rose from nothing to $627 million in 2012. Mm-hmm. So just in 2012, we did $627. Well, the buyout was back-end loaded. So they owed me and my partners, two of us, the other partner got out the year before. They owed us $105 million between the three of us, $34.5 million each. We got $20 million each the year before, so you know, it wasn't like we got nothing. And in 2012, we did $627, $95 million in EBITDA. They owned the company technically in that buyout.
Yep.
They dividend up to their company $90 million, $5 million left in the bank. The next quarter, they're now supposed to pay us the 104.5.
Yep.
And they just forgot to do that. So they're like, okay, guys, we got a problem. We owe you $105 million. We can't afford to pay it. So you either bankrupt us, you sue us, you chase us for it, or we figure it out. And we had no choice. Our fourth partner, the one that got out the year before,
yep,
is his fucking dad that bought the company. So our chief strategy officer and our first investor, his dad now owns the company, right?
Wow.
So we're in this sandwich of brother, best friend, first investor, and dad, and they owe us $105 million. So we're like, all right, we'll work it out. I know it's a long story, but...
That's a good one. I love business stories.
We're like, all right, we'll work it out. And skipping to the end, because it's probably another 10 minutes, is it never gets worked out.
Yeah.
So imagine for 2 years... You got these three guys in their early 30s that don't legally own the company, but are the face of the most viral thing created in a decade and maybe ever in social media at that time window. I mean, $1 billion in sales from zero in 36 months, the first billion. And we don't own the company, but we're the face of it. Everyone follows us. We have all the influence. They're taking all the money. They're dividending up all the money. It was a fucking crisis. So I remember, and... I got to think through this because I've signed at least 100 NDAs of what I'm not allowed to say.
You incriminate yourself in the next few minutes.
Yeah,
and chop it out.
We just edit this out.
If people see chops. That's what happens.
But I'm okay with this one. I remember in 2013, my partner's the CEO looks at us and goes, "Fuck that! This ain't happening again. We're spending it all this year. We're gonna spend everything so they don't get it."
Yep.
So you talk about a bad management practice. Our partner's trying to spend all the money in the bank so that the guys that bought us, who owe us $105 million, don't get it. Nobody's like really focused on what we should be doing to make this company outstanding, because we don't know what happens if we do. Are you guys going to keep taking the money? Like, or are we going to have to sue you? And if we sue you, or do we all go out of business? So, you know, and it created some health issues for some in the group. It created some, you know, extreme crises of personal lives in the founder group.
Definitely. It's got to be demotivating as an entrepreneur to see all of your spoils just disappear.
It's uncertainty. You don't know. Yes. You don't know what's going to happen next. And we're now expanding into Europe. And what's hardest about this is the best thing about network marketing is anybody can get involved. There's no barrier to entry. The worst thing about network marketing is anybody can get involved. Mm. So we can't just go educate. Our biggest month was 117,000 active salespeople. My job was to create all things that attracted and led those salespeople and trained, and you get the idea. So how do you go tell 100,000 salespeople who are part-time, spare time, most of them soccer moms, this story I just told you a fraction of? They're not going to get any of that. And if we do tell them that, are they going to keep selling?
Right.
Are they going to get paralyzed? Are they going to quit? Are they going to leave to another company? So we were stuck in this really just extremely difficult position where we couldn't share what was going on. We had to put the smiling face on. It's crisis behind the scenes. It's crisis in people's personal life. We never got paid. So there's just nonstop resentment. But they own the company, so we can't do shit without board approval. We can't expand to this country. We can't launch a new product. We can't change the comp plan. So imagine that level of resentment. You got all the money, own the company, haven't paid us, and you're going to tell us what the fuck to do every day?
You probably would have left and sued them if not for all the success you guys were having with the challenge.
The moment you do that, you lose all your distributors because everyone's going to go, oh, uncertainty. There's no stability in that sales force.
Yeah.
It's not like these are employees that are like, hey, we know you're gonna pay us and da da da. They can go to another company. They can go to Beachbody, which many of them did, at any moment. They can go to any copycat at any moment. So,
how did that resolve? What was the resolution of that debacle?
I still cry myself to sleep.
What an experience, though, as an entrepreneur. What a roller coaster to go through.
So there is a legal answer to what you said, which how did it resolve? So they tried to spin us out and take us public. And 1 week before, we pulled the plug on it for a very intelligent, important reason. But it was, I don't know, the second worst day of our business career, next to the day they didn't pay us the $34.5 million, was the day we canceled the IPO. Mm-hmm. And we're talking, we're supposed to ring the bell on Monday or Tuesday. I forget which day you ring the bell. Monday or Tuesday. And we're in the meeting 7 days earlier after the whole roadshow's done. Mm-hmm. And we cancel the IPO, which triggers class action lawsuits everywhere because we're owned by a publicly traded company. And when you do that, ambulance chasers will automatically fire off class actions. Hey, were you wronged? Because it looks like you were trying to pump the stock up. Mm-hmm. And then, just kidding, we're not going public. And you look like you were doing that on purpose, or they claim that you are. So we had to go fight that, or the company that owned us had to go fight it for 3 years. That got thrown out. But when our distributors, who are soccer moms, see that, they lose trust. The brand loyalty falters, right? So it doesn't get resolved that way. We battle them for 2 more years. The company falls back so quickly that the value of the company had reduced to $180 million. Mm-hmm. So our $700 million company is now worth $200. And they go, take it, it's yours. So they just give the company back, which is on a fucking downslide.
Yeah.
Which is great because we get the equity back and we believe we can turn around. But also means every legal issue and every financial issue is now our issue. Mm-hmm. We got to put the money back in. We got to go raise the money. So that's how it was resolved. It was resolved by the company fell back so fast based on all this crisis that it became a transaction and we get our equity back for the value of the company, what's left.
That is a crazy story. What a roller coaster for an entrepreneur to go through.
It could have had a great ending, but it didn't.
What are the lessons from that story that you think about?
Great question. So going back in time, I'm such a person of faith, of people, mm-hmm. and just like, you do what's right, I'll do what's right, and let's just, and team, and just camaraderie, and, you know, trusting your partners, and I have no idea how many 100-page contracts I've signed, where all I did is I looked at the two who were responsible for the contracts and legal.
Yeah.
And I said, does yours say the same thing mine says? I don't even know if it ever did.
I'm the same way.
Because I don't know what it says, even if I do read this fucking thing. So, okay, I'm not that smart. I dropped out of community college, y'all. Like, so I just said, if you signed it, I'm signing it, right? So I just hoped and believed that they just would have done the most fair thing, but business is not always fair. What would have been fair is, I don't know, let's split this $90 million. By the way, they took $30 million the next year of our EBITDA. Let's split this $120 million between all of us, even though we technically legally own the company on the shares, on the stock certificate, mm-hmm. and we owe you $105 million. They should never say, hey, you can fucking bankrupt us, or you can foreclose on us, or you can reverse merger us, or we can spin you out. Those are your options. It should have been like, all right, we're taking $90 million. Let's figure, like, it really just boiled down to the letter of the contract and the letter of the law. And if I could have done it all over again, I would have said, fuck that. Let's take it. Let's go as hard and as fast as we can to get our money. Even though I'm not a shark, I'm not a person that leads with money, and I don't like anything legal. I don't like the energy around any of that.
Right.
And I was just hoping that it would be resolved the right way, and it never was.
It's a good lesson, especially when you get into those big numbers like that, and you're talking about these giant corporations that own a bunch of companies and the people at the top of those things. It's not the same business ethics and morals that we're probably used to running our day-to-day startups and business partnerships. So that's an interesting dynamic that I've never encountered personally. But. Yep.
Well, they would argue all day long that what's ethical is what's written in the contract.
Yes.
And so they were forcing us into a reaction,
mm-hmm.
right? But I don't believe that was the right way to handle it. At the end of the day, you know, that company took out $120 million in back-to-back dividends and didn't pay the three. And the other founder, who's a son, got out the year earlier with $40 million. So there's $160 million to the company and the family. And, you know, they never paid us the last 104, right? 0.5. But who's counting?
crazy story, Nick. Appreciate you. Well, through all of that, you grew a massive company, yeah. built massive influence, probably yes. learned a ton
yes.
about scaling, running large teams. At one point, what is the number of salespeople that you were managing, training?
The biggest point was 117,000.
117,000 salespeople under you.
Now, again, it's network marketing, so they're part-time, right. spare time, and then 3,000 of them were full-time. 35 of them were making between $35,000 a month and $300,000 a month. So I was the point person that led those 35, and I was in charge of creating. I owned the training company, so every event that was thrown, every slide, every word that was said, every speaker that spoke on the stage, every script, every video, all of it was, you know, we had an inner circle of 5 to 10 of us, and I led the inner circle, and it was the greatest PhD times 100 of sales leadership.
Oh, I can imagine. One of the problems that I've had over the course of my business career is inspiring people to want to come and sell your product and service. What is the secret to that? How do you get people to want to sell your thing?
Well, there's a lot of channels to that, right? So there's people that work for you.
Mm-hmm.
So you're recruiting internal talent. There's strategic partners who are external. And those have very different answers.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So let's talk about the internal one, the ones that are working for you.
Yes.
There's recruiting, there's retaining, and then there's growing sales teams.
Let's break that down.
And those are all three different topics, right?
Yep.
So if you're recruiting a sales team, everyone needs vision. Like the janitor needs vision, the whatever the role is needs vision. But salespeople are the most susceptible, not in a bad way, but in a good, like required. It's in their blood. Like they have to have vision like oxygen.
Hmm.
So number one is, can you be a person that has a very crystal clear vision that is constantly communicated, unwavering, and they can repeat back to you to the point of annoyance, right? And if not, then you're not going to have a sales team that's sold out to what you're doing.
Yeah.
And the ones that kind of like make a joke, or you can see their body language when you're preaching the vision, those aren't the ones you want. If that body language changes, you want salespeople who are just indoctrined into your vision, whatever that is.
Yeah.
And I don't care if that is somebody that makes 50 grand a year or 500 grand a year. They've got to be sold out because they love it. Otherwise, you're getting mercenaries.
Yes.
And mercenaries will sell whatever the hell that you're selling as long as they get paid. And, you know, I hate that type of sales and that type of, I don't hate that type of salesperson. I hate that type of sales. And I don't love working with that type of salesperson.
Yeah. I don't think anyone likes being sold by that type of salesperson.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think really important nugget there for business owners to have a really clear mission and vision for the company.
Must be.
Because that's how you inspire people to come on board and give 110%, not just get by.
That's how you recruit.
Yeah.
Like, and it's this is probably one of the questions that I'm going to do at RiseCon, which is, you know, well, I'm not great at sales. I'm just going to outsource sales. I'm going to have somebody else do sales. I'm like, so you're not going to recruit? Well, you're going to have executives? Well, yeah, who's going to recruit them? The HR person? Like, recruiting is sales.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you're not going to raise capital? Well, that's the biggest sale of the company, is you're selling the company to buyers, right? That's sales. So you're selling your product, you're selling your vision, you're recruiting people, you're bringing on investors. That's sales, 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 and sales. So there is no entrepreneur that's not selling, right? You're always selling. And the vision part of it, what happens is, especially logical and technical entrepreneurs, they get caught up in the strategy.
Right.
And here's what's, I'm going to say dumb about that. Here's why I believe that's a misstep. You spend all this time on strategy, 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 strategy. Strategy is guaranteed to change by the month. Mm-hmm. Guaranteed. Because even if you have the most perfect strategy, what you're saying is the world's not going to change. We had the most perfect strategy in the world to roll out our acquisition. We got acquired recently by a much larger company 3 years ago. You know what happened the month after the acquisition of our European sales force?
What happened?
COVID.
What are you going to do?
Acquisition happened February 15th, something like that, March 15th. Our biggest country was Italy, which was the hotbed of COVID in Europe.
Yep.
We were doing $6 million a month in sales just out of Italy.
Jesus.
Couldn't go there. They couldn't meet with each other.
Yeah.
And we just became a new company during that transition. So shove your strategy up your ass. Yeah. The only reason those people stayed was vision.
Yes.
Right. So your strategy is always guaranteed to be shifting and changing all the time. So sitting there and constantly preaching how, and trying to figure out how, as opposed to making sure everybody's bought into the vision. The vision is, this is where the fuck we're going. The strategy is how. You don't have to change where we're going, but this how is always going to change.
Yes. That's a great answer, vision. I think not a lot of people, even myself included, doesn't always consider that when they're selling. But I think it's the most important thing. Now let's go to the next one, which is development. Do you tend to hire salespeople who are experienced, have gone through formal sales training, or does that not matter to you? Entry level, you'll develop them yourself. What's your opinion there?
So I've been on the most far extremes of both, the most extreme polarities. So direct sales network marketing is by default the least experienced people.
Right.
So my muscle for my first 22 years, I wasn't a leader for the first 3 years. So we'll say 19 years of sales leadership was dedicated to developing first-time, you know, part-time, spare-time entrepreneurs and how to get them past their fears and how to get them hard skills and the mindset and emotional intelligence to make it. And then I became specialized in developing the leaders of those people. Mm-hmm. But my current business model of what I do today is actually the most extreme opposite. If direct sales is about building an army, right now I'm just about building the Navy SEALs. Mm-hmm. you have to have made $250,000 a year or more in sales in something and then be a match for our culture, growth, joy, social impact. And if you're, if you have the qualifications and you're a match for culture, then we talk about, is there a fit for you, right? So I've done both. Both work. Both are hard. That's not true. It's much harder to develop someone from scratch. It's much harder. Much more rewarding to see them have their breakthroughs and earn at a level they've never earned.
Is that because you think there's a natural ability to sell and those people can be developed, but some might take a little bit longer? Why is it so hard sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, if you put everyone through a strength finder, you're going to immediately see the differences in all of them, right?
Yeah.
And the people that have greater strengths in the influence category are going to be better at sales easily, right? But you can teach the other people to sell. It's just going to be harder for them.
Yeah. And they may have a different style.
Yeah, and you're correct. They might be figuring out ways to a funnel hack or whatever, right? And, you know, just because they're more strategic thinkers, so they figure out how to sell through strategic thinking as opposed to just pure charisma.
Yes.
But you know, the I'm not sure if that answered the question, but yeah, I think there's obviously people have a natural tendency to it. Getting back to the higher performers, my current business model is this. I don't want to manage anyone. I only want to lead. And if you need to be managed, you can't work with us. Mm-hmm. I want people that I don't need to motivate you. You know what you're supposed to be doing. My job is to inspire you and give you vision and give you a workplace environment that you love, as opposed to being a pharma rep with a microchip shoved up your ass to track you every stop you make, how many miles you're driving. You're like, what kind of life is that? Like, you're making 150 doing that? Come make 200 with me and you're going to have the time of your life, right?
Yeah, not going to check how many texts you're sending, how many minutes you're spending on the
phone. If I have to do that, I have the wrong person.
Listen to all your recordings.
Yeah, like if I have to do any of that, I've got the wrong person.
Yes.
But I also see, even with our guys, how that can be abused, right? Yeah. Where that can be taken advantage of because I'm not going to babysit.
Well, you look at their bigger numbers. So Nick, you're fortunate enough now to be able to, one, afford people who are trained and they know what to expect. They've already made money in sales. They need to come in knowing that they're going to earn well with you. That's not cheap to be able to do. And two, you have a name and a brand where people want to come work with you and for you. Not a lot of entrepreneurs listening are fortunate in that manner. For example, when we started, we couldn't afford good salespeople. We hired someone straight out of college. It was Gabby. And essentially taught her how to sell, and neither of us were trained in sales either. What are your key concepts, your key lessons for developing a salesperson from scratch? Anything low-hanging fruit that can escalate their career quickly?
There has to be someone that will dive in with that person and show them how to do it. It's like skiing or surfing. You can't just tell someone how to do that. Like, so here's how you surf. You do this, you do this, you do this. Go get them, Tiger.
Yeah.
You know, you could probably do that with certain things in a business. Like, here, just watch this video and then go do that. Right. You know, it's like we trained a monkey, we can train you too. It's easy. Sales, you have to, like, there's something about the emotional connection where a person needs to see and feel and touch you doing it and get it, seeing you with the victory. And it's such an emotional roller coaster.
It is.
Watching you, how you handle all your rejections. Mm-hmm. Like, let's say you're going to get 2 out of 10. That person is taught more about how you respond in those 8 rejections than the 2 wins.
Yeah.
Right. If they can see that you don't care about those 8 rejections, or you're learning from those 8 rejections, or those 8 rejections, you figured out how to navigate to another connection or another referral, you know, anything where there's an upside, they're learning from that more than they're learning from the W's. And you have to have that person see, whoever the sales leader is, lose and win enough times. And then it's, all right, I'm going to do half, you're going to do half. All right, you're going to do the whole thing, I'm going to watch you do it. All right, let's do it 10 times. Let's see how it goes. And you're constantly stopping and changing and stopping and adapting and stopping and coaching. And if you have the right person, they should get better.
Yeah.
You know, so if they're not getting any better, you know, you got the wrong person. And I know, I think everything I said is very basic, but people want to, they want to sidestep the basics of that.
Right. The fundamentals are always the most important thing. They're never the sexiest.
You can take the greatest athlete in the world and you can't just give them a surfboard and say, go get them.
Right.
You must go out there with them. And it doesn't matter how great of an athlete they are. You must just coach them through this failure over and over and over and over and over again until they're finally up on the board, and then until they're finally doing it by themselves, until they're finally like, I don't even need you to be here anymore, right? So, and that's I guess, the path of what you're trying to do with a salesperson.
That's great advice. And the third piece you mentioned for sales leadership was retention.
Yeah.
How do you keep A-plus talent? They're rare. How do you hold on to them?
Culture. The best talent, if they're not inspired by the people around them, they'll go find a place that inspires them. Mm-hmm. So there's an old saying, if you're the head of a table, find a new table. Right. So, you know, and that's department-based. Excuse me. That's not department-based. Right. I mean, they got to look at the other departments and go, we got great people in every department, right? So you retain them through lifestyle, recognition, growth, financial. These are all different triggers or different levers, excuse me, right? Everyone usually just looks at the financial. Mm-hmm. But somebody is going to go somewhere else that they're valued more, or that there's a better culture, or that there's a better growth opportunity than they are if it's just, hey, I got a raise.
Right.
So you got to figure out which lever to pull and when to pull it. Anytime I've gone against this part of the philosophy, it's worked against me. Do not trade culture for results. Don't like, if you got somebody that's just all about the money, then eventually that's going to run out with you and they will leave you for someone else that will pay them more. So you want people that like to make money and they want to make a lot of it, but they also love the fact that we're going to the conference together. We're all going to UPW Tony Robbins together.
Right.
If they're not jacked up about that and see that as a value add, then you know that that person has a short time with you.
Yes.
If you're doing team events, like, hey, we're doing beach volleyball day, and this person never shows up, that person's time is limited.
Yeah.
If you're doing something that's social impact based and they're like, this is a drag to go contribute to society, that person's short term with you, right? So there's different, by the way, lifestyle levers are great as well. So instead of, let me give you $2,500, it might be for a bonus. It might be, let me give you the life experience that you've never done before that cost me $2,000 to give to you, because you're going to remember the experience way more than you remember the money.
Yeah, and associate it with the role and with the company.
Yes, and then recognition. Recognition is a lever.
Mm.
You know, babies cry for it, grown men die for it. So it's, most people say they quit their job for not being recognized for the job that they're doing. They don't get the job well done. They get told all the shit they don't do. They don't get told the shit that they are doing.
Oh, that's great advice all around for the sales leadership and development. I know you split it off into two categories. One was the Navy SEALs, and the other was the MLM, the moms.
Yeah. Moms.
The stay-at-home moms who are dominating MLM sales.
Currently single moms. Single moms. I'm single, single moms. Sorry.
No, I love it.
That was my shameless
This plug guy line. Is single. Ladies, if you're watching, Nick Sarnicola is a catch, lives in Miami.
Two kids. So, single moms. You know, Brady Bunch. Okay.
Women like that.
Yeah.
You're a family guy.
Ones that are moms like that. Ones that aren't usually, I'm not first on their list.
Right. It's fair enough.
Yeah. Anyway, so what are we talking about?
The dynamic in inspiring moms to come sell for you and developing that and having them do it part-time. What is that like? What is the success rate like? I mean, how many times you've onboarded a mom, taught her what you needed?
That's the hardest one for me, actually, because I started direct sales networking at 18. So my team was always just young, hard chargers, male and female.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look back, we had definitely the more masculine thinking females. I was definitely driving out anyone that was a caretaker or that was a lover or that was, I didn't value the role of a community or a gatherer until much later.
Yeah.
So it was, for my first 12 years, it was just all young, hard chargers, and that was it. Then when we started Visalis and we're selling a high-end anti-aging product, I mean, 23-year-olds like, I don't know what this is. I don't know if I'm feeling this or not. I don't know. It's great for hangovers.
Yeah, that's, I've been
that's
there.
Not the point. You know? Like, it's not for hangovers. So we had to get some old people in.
Yep.
I am the old person now. But at the time, we're like, we had to find someone over 40 because we were all 25.
Right.
So now all of a sudden we have this whole new demographic and we're building with couples. And then it's like, wait a second. 70% of direct sales network marketing is female and it's stay-at-home moms. So here I am pitching this vision always of my passion for 22 years was getting you out of your job. I would do anything to get you out of your job. So your goal is to make $8,000 a month so you can get out of your job and fire your boss. I want to show up with the limo outside with 100 of us in your team the day you fucking fire your boss and you walk out. And we go and have party for the day and then we go back to build our business, right? Yeah. And we did that hundreds and hundreds of times. So it wasn't retirement. They weren't retirement. They were firing their boss to become a full-time entrepreneur.
Yep.
So that was my passion. I would call it unplug you from the matrix. Yeah. Then all of a sudden I'm like, wait a second, a stay-at-home mom doesn't want to fire their boss because their boss is their kids. This is a mind fuck.
And I couldn't, what do I say?
I couldn't motivate them the same way I was motivating everyone else, which right. was let's make money to get you out of your job. And you're like, I ain't trying to get out of my job. So I could push people to the limit of time and effort and late nights, etc., because they wanted to break through to get 10, 12, 15, 20 grand a month and be an entrepreneur. The stay-at-home mom's just trying to get to two. Mm-hmm. And she's trying to limit the amount of time doing that.
Right.
And I can't even, in fact, as I'm sitting here with you, I don't think I ever mastered that. I think the women in network marketing that you see that have these huge social media brands that are making 100 grand a month, they mastered that. And they're leading, you know, like, you know, mompreneur and CEO mom and boss mom. Those are usually network marketing moms.
It's a lot more relatable too when it's coming from another mom that's already doing it.
Way more relatable, right? So
you're some 25-year-old kid.
I don't think I ever mastered it, but I learned in my last 5 to 7 years to not push the stay-at-home mom beyond her limitation of what she wanted.
Yes.
And that was hard. It was super hard.
And relatable question there for me and for other entrepreneurs. And you said affiliate marketing is essentially the new MLM. It's basically the
depends
same
how many
thing.
Levels it is.
Yeah. Right. We use affiliates. Yep. We use partners. A lot of software companies and stuff have affiliates. Any tricks there to activate affiliate marketers to go and sell your stuff?
Affiliate marketers usually are less inspired by the offer and more inspired by the money. Mm-hmm. Like I've seen some people sell some shit. Like this is so I might not be the affiliate marketing and network marketing. Those two worlds were at war at first, and now they're starting to blend a little bit because a lot of the times in network marketing, not all the time, but a lot of the times the good companies and the good leaders, they will not sell shit just to sell shit. And they truly care about their team and the people and the consumer. And it's community-based marketing.
Yeah.
What affiliate marketing is, how big of a list do we have? How do we push this out? What gray area do we operate in to get them to click? What clickbait? I mean, I remember so many assholes using my pictures on Facebook ads to get people to click. I find that to be very shady.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just shady. So it's a... Maybe I had some resentment here. I had to get out. Sorry. So, you know, I'm not an expert in that world because early on, I think the email marketers and the clickbait marketers, all they cared about was what was the offer? What psychological terms and words do we have to use to get people to buy? And it doesn't matter that it's a knockoff of the real product that actually works because that ingredient's patented. You got a fake ingredient knockoff that actually doesn't even absorb. Your body just pisses it out, or it won't throw you into ketosis, or you're just leveraging the trend of what's working to make money. So I have a deep philosophical difference with that. So I don't know if I know how to motivate them. But I'm sure there's a pocket of them that are inspiration based. And I think if you can find the niche that matches your offering, that is inspiration based, not just money based, offer based.
Yes.
And you can get good at finding those niches and speak to their listening and make them feel like they're a real part of a movement. I think that's the home run. Make them feel like they're a part of a movement. Otherwise, we're just selling shit just to sell shit.
Yeah, definitely a challenge with affiliates, but I definitely appreciate the insight. I think you're correct.
You know, I think everyone now is open to referring something to make money.
Yeah.
Whether they're going to build a team for it, network marketing,
yeah,
or it's a one-level affiliate, which is an affiliate that gets an affiliate that gets an affiliate that gets an affiliate, right? Whether it's that, or a two-level affiliate, I think you can find niches that match your vision. You can create a cause around that and drive product sales through it. I got to go back to this training. Give me a second. So there's cause-based marketing, which is like, hey, we're doing this for the blank cause, right? And there's niche-based marketing, which is, you know, we're gonna activate the Spanish-speaking female community between age 30 and 40, right? We're only gonna sell to that niche, right? So I think if you can combine a cause to certain niches and activate those niches who are most influential, let's call that a local-based influencer.
Yep.
And you can figure out who those are and you can activate them. Those are the ones that you want as your affiliates.
Right. Figure out who's going to best be your affiliate, which niche. Focus on that. Focus on
commission only, 30%.
Yep.
Fine. You know, we use the term soccer mom. That's not a joke. That's a compliment.
Yeah.
Right. That woman was a lawyer. that woman is way smarter than I am. And now she's using all that influence and intelligence and brilliance to run the family and activate the community, et cetera. She can sell some shit. Like,
right.
You got a great skincare product, or you got a great, you know, you want to do beta testing of sales. Find that soccer mom of influence, give her 30% of sales, but she's got to fall in love with whatever the product is.
Right. Give her a purpose, give her a vision,
give her a cause around it. And you know, not to build a sales force, but just to straight sell it.
Yes.
Give her a high commission on it. It's a great way to figure out which markets are really going to want the product you're offering.
That's a great insight. Speaking of soccer moms.
Long answer, but if you asked me that again, I would just say that last part.
No, the last part, I think.
Put on all of that shit if you want.
I agree. That's the nugget there. That's beautiful. Speaking of soccer moms and building a family.
We spoke a lot about soccer moms.
We did. And you're a soccer dad. I don't know if they play soccer, but
yeah, my son is a soccer player. Yeah.
There you go. I was a soccer player growing up. I think it's a great sport as a kid to get involved in. So you've got your kids on stage with you. I've seen the clips. What are your secrets right now to raising kids in this crazy world, in the school system? What are you doing to
give them
the best
specific
chance at success?
So I always knew I would teach my kids a family curriculum.
Mm.
So I have a family curriculum, and it needs to be moved to tangible, because right now it's just here and in their heads. And it's just like, in all the things in a day, I got to create an LMS to get that out of here and out of their heads into something so other families can have it. But I'm a single dad. And my ex-wife is, we're 50-50, but I'm still a single dad.
Yep.
So I've got half the time that I get to see them.
Yep.
Well, I also work easily 80 hours a week. So they're at school 5 days a week, 7 hours a day. So it's 35 hours a week. The school's got them.
Yep.
And I don't know what the fuck they're learning there, but I know it's at least traditional education.
Yeah.
Right. So, which is not conducive for an entrepreneurial environment.
No.
So I've got 15 days a month versus 30 that school's got them, or 22. 22 times 7, they got them 150 hours a week. I've got them for 15 days a month for maybe 30 minutes, sometimes 45, that I can say, all right, family curriculum time. And they know We're talking nothing about anything else except entrepreneurship, leadership, non-traditional education topics, investing, financial literacy, social impact, any of these terms, philanthropy, and they can rattle shit off. Like, it's crazy. And they can rattle it off by definition, and now they can do it from a practical perspective, because every day on the way to school, when I drive them, which sounds like 22 days a month, but it's not. It might be, it depends on just the genetic makeup of the month and the calendar. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's 8-9 days a month. We start a business or a real estate investment every day on the way to school. So we'll get in the car, we'll drive for 5 minutes, and we'll talk. I'm like, all right, business or real estate? And they'll decide. And they're like, oh, real estate. I'm like, all right, pick it. So we're driving. That piece of land right there. All right, what are we doing? And my six-year-old will yell out, apartment, you know, or whatever. He'll yell, or six houses, right? And so he'll start, I let him kind of pick it because he can't do the math.
Yeah.
And then I'll start doing the math with, you know, my daughter who's 10. Okay, he wants to build 5 units. And I kind of let her pick numbers. How much is it going to cost? A little bit higher, a little lower. You know? And all of a sudden, she's building out an OPEX that's like, all right, you know, we built it out for $2 million. We sold them for $3.5, made a $1.5 million profit. We split it 50-50. It's $750,000 each. She's rattling this off with a calculator. And I'm like, all right, Nicholas, you got $750. What are you doing with it? All right, I can reinvest it. I can spend it. I can give it away, or I can save it. I'm like, all right, we go through the exercise again. How much are you going to spend on things that you want and need? Like, they'll be like, oh, things I want, this. Now you can't get a Ferrari off that, buddy. Like, and then we get to school. We do our IAMs, which are essentially incantations. They pick 5 words. They're yelling them out, and boom, they're in school. So I've got 10 hours to 15 hours a month to try to outpace school and iPad
right
with my own education.
There's probably a lot of parents out there, you know, like us entrepreneurs who don't want their kids fully exposed to traditional education. Is there anything that you're doing to shield them from influence from the traditional school system, and anything like after school programs or specialty schools and mentors that you've utilized or have looked into?
So it's the hardest part of being divorced is, you know, Grant Cardone, he homeschools his kids. And he says on stage, I homeschool my kids, not because of my kids, but because of your fucking kids. I don't want your kids around my kids.
Yeah.
Like, he just,
I get that.
It's like, so I get it too. Like, I don't want whatever's going on in your head passing to your kid and those broke ideas. And I get it 100%.
Yeah.
My ex-wife is higher education. Mm-hmm. She graduated magna cum laude, 3 years, double major. Her dad is a PhD who teaches college students how to get a PhD in electrical engineering. I don't know if there's a higher level of a PhD that teaches PhD. Like, it's the highest level educator you get. Her mom was a teacher. So for me, I'm like, please, God, don't tell me you're going to college. Like, just like start a business, travel the world. And then later, if you want to go to college, waste your own damn money. But unless you want to be a doctor, go to college. Right.
Right.
So, longer answer to get back to say, you know, every day that I'm with them, and even when I call them, they know there's 3 questions. What was the best part about school today? What did you learn today? And what did you not like today? And I'm fishing.
Yeah.
I'm fishing so I can deprogram stuff.
Right.
Ah, what did your teacher say? Really? So Nicholas is hyperactive as fuck. Well, what do you expect? I'm his dad. Her mother's just as hyperactive. She's actually growing up was clinically diagnosed ADD or ADHD, right? And they wanted to put me on Ritalin since I was 5. So this kid doesn't have a chance. And the teachers don't know how to handle this at all.
Yeah.
So the school's very, very slow, and keep our hands to ourselves, and this is quiet time. And just, it's like really extreme.
Yeah.
Really extreme. So I had to, they started doing daily progress reports with the poor kid. And it got, at first I was like punishing him, if you will, not punishing, but I was having talks with him.
Right.
Then by the second week, I'm like, wait, they gave you a so-so because you tripped on your own feet and they put, you couldn't control your own body. Like, so finally I'm going to bed going, Nicholas, listen. And he was sad that he was getting so-so and not yeses.
Yeah.
He's six.
Of course. He needs validation. Yeah.
He's six. I'm like, listen, you're not a bad kid doing anything bad.
Yeah.
Your hyperactiveness is your superpower. Trust me. When everyone else wants to go take a nap and everyone else wants to quit and everyone else is tired and you're going full force. So he now is being reinstilled that his energy is his superpower, where he's being taught at school that it's his, what's the opposite of superpower? It's the bad thing.
A handicap, a disease, handicap. One that would normally require.
His hyperactive as an energy is his handicap. I'm like, fuck that, it's your superpower, kid. Like,
yeah.
So yeah, I am constantly fishing for what I need to shift and reprogram, but I don't make enemies out of the teachers or the parent. I just make them think about it from another direction.
That's a great point. And yeah, a lot of parents need to hear that. Kids with ADD who can't sit still in class will typically just reach for the Adderall and the Vyvanse and the Ritalin. And it is a superpower. But I mean, I can imagine being a kid with ADD sitting there watching the most boring human on earth try and lecture me about something after coming from, you know, engaging with you all day.
Yeah.
Of course you're bored. Of course you can't sit still. But yeah, man, tell the kid that it's going to be okay.
Yep.
Then don't reach for the Adderall and the Ritalin.
Yep, I agree.
All right, final questions, Nick. What are you talking about at RiseCon? What can we expect to hear from you? What lessons are we going to learn?
You know, so RiseCon, you know, Vic has done a great job of positioning RiseCon of being not just another personal growth event.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted all of us to be very strategy-based, how-tos, like real meat.
Good.
And so that's a different type of attendee.
Yeah.
That type of attendee is looking for something to chew on that they can implement at the break.
Mm-hmm.
So that changes, because I can go lots of different directions. I can go hardcore mindset, but what he's saying is hardcore skill set. So I'm going to go hardcore skill set, and my superpower, sales leadership, biz dev, focus, expansion, hiring, recruiting, culture. So I'm going to go a lot of stuff in that direction. And then also, how do I involve my kids daily in entrepreneurship? So they're going to speak at the end as well. They're going to lay it down.
I'm excited to see them and to meet them. You're speaking on Saturday. Is that correct?
Saturday. Yep. Saturday. I think we're like 3:30 or 4.
Cool. Well, hopefully we can kick it in the speaker's lounge for a little while.
Oh.
And thank you for stopping by, coming in. I learned a ton. Where can people go to support you? Is there anything that you offer in terms of services, coaching, products? Yeah. Where can we go and support you? And
how's not a coach. I'm not a coach. I'm a leader. Which yes. means I build companies and I lead people inside of that. But if you're a real estate agent, I have renewable.realestate, which is a way for real estate agents to increase their income an extra 20% per year. You can check that out. And I also have a free Telegram community that I just drop content to and just answer questions. That's catalystlaunch.com.
Cool.
Go to catalystlaunch.com and redirect you to Telegram. You can just join the Telegram group and you might get some value. Yeah.
We'll drop all that in the show notes here. Nick, this has been a blast. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.